What a finish from Balogun.
Oh, Benyera, beautifully done.
Aubameyang, surely. There it is.
Mbappe now. Wonderful.
Gotta be. Lovely finish.
Go for goal. Darren Mbappe.
It's Elie Wahi. Well, it's been coming.
Put in by Jonathan Davies. Kylian Mbappe brings the Parc des Princes to its feet.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Le Beaujeu, the official Ligue 1 Uber Eats podcast in English. Ligue 1 is back after the international break, and so are we. We're going to review all the major talking points from the weekend's action, where first-place PSG were held by bottom side Clermont. The race for Europe is reaching fever pitch, and the battle to avoid the drop is as dramatic as ever, even if you're a Clermont president or a Le Havre president. A little bit controversial as well. We're also going to review the Coupe de France semi-finals, preview the massive continental clashes as we reach the pointy end of the European season. Back in Ligue 1, our expert JJ previews Olympique Lyonnais versus Paris Saint-Germain, and Andy Scott's going to tell us what he likes most about Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang's season. We've also got our Deja Vu quiz winner of the Teddy Tuma jersey and a first clue to try and win a signed Terem Moffi shirt. All of that and a whole lot more with myself, Robbie Thompson. Very pleased to say I'm joined by Ligue 1 and PSG TV commentator Andreas Evagora. Andreas, how was your weekend? Are you all pumped up and ready for a big chat about Ligue 1?
Yeah, certainly am. It was an interesting game at PSG the weekend, so definitely lots to talk about today.
Absolutely. And we're also joined by Baptiste Renault of Le Classique Pod, which delves into all the French flair of the English game. Baptiste, thank you for joining us. How is the other side of the channel?
All good, all good. Relatively sunny, which means it's not raining. That's the British way of saying it.
I remember once when I was living in France and I headed across to England and I was on the, I caught the tube in from the airport. Or no, we might have been arrived on the Eurostar, and we were in the tube anyway, heading out. A friend had come to meet us and I saw someone reading a newspaper and it said, heat wave, you know, look out, look out. And I said to my friend, oh, geez, there's a heat wave coming, is there? And she goes, this is it. It's like 24 degrees. Maybe it was 26. But people were really suffering in London. Yeah, it's funny. Anyway, leave us a review, spread the word about the podcast, like, subscribe, follow, and recommend. We're on all your major podcast platforms. So let's start with a look back at everything that happened in rounds 27 and 28. We're going to get to Paris Saint-Germain, the league leaders, in a little bit when we look ahead to their tie in the Champions League quarterfinals against FC Barcelona. Those two just can't seem to keep away from each other. So we'll be chatting PSG a little bit later. Stick around for that. We're going to start with Brest. Andreas, in round 27, it was a 1-0 win over Lorient. In round 28, they really turned on the style. They were up 4-1 at one point. Metz came fighting back. They were trailing early, actually, to Metz, who stunned the home crowd. But Brest, they're still there. They're still fighting. And now, even though we know it's going to be difficult for them to play Champions League football at home because their stadium, which was built in 18-something or other, has not been, you know, given the all clear, the UEFA tick for nice, shiny European football, they are almost there. I mean, they are literally almost in Europe next season. They've never finished higher than eighth in Ligue 1. And that was when they had a fantastic team back in the late 80s. They're going to do it, aren't they?
I would be really surprised if they're not top three. And, you know, yesterday during the game, the crowd was singing songs about Europe and we're in Europe, which really annoyed Eric Waugh, who's, you know, one of these down-to-earth, realistic guys. He's like, well, there's a long way to go. But if you look at the table and you look at how they're playing, I mean, yesterday, four goals, really good at set pieces. They changed things around a little bit. Dombia played in a different position, a little bit further forward. But you just have to say, Eric Waugh keeps getting these results. And he does what good coaches do. He just makes good players better. And yesterday, Del Castillo was outstanding. Now, Del Castillo is a guy who's been around a few years. He's kind of, I would have thought he's a lower league and kind of player. All respect to him, you know, a guy who can play in the lower. He's looking like an outstanding player now. He's like Champions League player. So I'd be really surprised if Brest don't get there. Good team. And I saw a comparison the other day with a couple of other teams around Europe who are doing well. Bologna in Italy and Girona in Spain. And they're also two teams who don't have any big stars like Brest, but they have great coaches. Thiago Motta, of course, in Bologna. I wonder if we'll see him in Ligue 1 one day. And it just shows that with a really well-drilled team, you can get the results. And I'd be surprised if they're not there. Oh, one note for Metz, though. This was a 1 o'clock kickoff, and I saw that some Metz fans did the aller-retour, as they say, the return trip in one day. And I did a quick Google map. It's 1,830 kilometers, Robbie, in one day. So hats off to those Mets. Well, I'd be amazed, but apparently some did. I mean, you'd have to get up really early and then come home really late. But, you know.
That's the joy if you have a designated driver. I mean, you're leaving home at 4 o'clock in the morning.
But there were some fans there.
You're already probably enjoying a few bevvies.
I would hope so from their point of view.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. No, they've got good fans. Mets fans was one of the – I loved the name, the Horda Frenetic. Yeah. It's such a great name, the Frenetic Horde for a bunch of crazy fans. It's just, brilliant. There are some fantastic fan group names around, but that one for me, I remember – when I went to Napoli on a Maradona pilgrimage a few years back and went into the Spanish quarter of Napoli, there are ultra tags all over the place. And one of them was Banda Alcoholica. And I just thought, that's brilliant. An alcoholic band, like a group of alcoholics. And that's where we're supporting Napoli. And that's what I get those vibes from the Horda Frenetica.
I'm sure Batty's can fill us in on that. On the white wine out in Metz. Sorry to interrupt, Robbie, but you know, these are important matters.
isn't Riesling region not too far away?
Yeah, not too far. And Champagne's not far away either from Metz, just down to Champagne. You, everyone knows for a good white wine, you need a little cooler climb. So you're not going
to
get
a little Gewürztraminer to get you through the day.
Exactly. Maybe that's what did the damage for the 1800 return trip. Maybe that's the fuel that got them through. Anyway, the Mets fans did have a lot to cheer about, but not enough. Not enough, unfortunately, for them. Mind you, Mikko Tadze, he's had a lot to cheer about during the international break, hasn't he? On his way to the Euros with Georgia, spectacular, eliminating Greece. I guess Andreas doesn't need to hear that. Really, something spectacular from the Georgians, a first ever appearance for the Mets striker on the European stage. Let's keep moving. Baptiste, Monaco, Balogun was at the double when they too got the better of Mets in another high scoring match, 5-2 this time. And then 1-0 win over Rennes, one of their young guns getting the only goal of the game. He has really impressed now in recent matches, Akliouche. He's really starting to hit his mark on the top stage. He's looking a real prospect. And I guess the way you look at it is that he's this latest product, because we don't talk about it as much as we talk about other clubs, but Monaco have a great history of bringing through young players. And maybe this is the next one. They've got a few actually at the moment coming through.
Yeah, you've got Ben Seguir, who's there as well, has caught the eye. Magnus Akliouche is quietly having a very impressive season for somebody who's just turned 22. He's got 8 goals and a few assists, and he looks very comfortable. And as you said, Robbie, Monaco have a really proud history of developing youngsters, even back in the days, obviously, Thierry Henry, David Trezeguet, the likes of Martin Gétou, Philippe Cristanval, who played for France and moved to Barcelona before his career went down the pan, really. But and obviously, you know, Mbappe started there and a number of players. So, you know, they always have that sort of recipe of having their youngsters and bringing in some good young players, which has been the model for a number of years. And I think what I found most impressive with their performance against Rennes is they looked a bit more solid. Obviously, Majeski in goal has pulled off a few good saves and looks more competent than Philip Coens, I think, is not an unfair thing to say. And so there's a bit more of a bit more stable baseline to move forward from, because after that, the likes of Akliush, Golovin, Minamino, you know, going forward, there's a lot to like. So a very promising win, I think, a hard fought win as well. And they could have imploded, but they didn't with the red card. So I think they're in good shape to push forward, especially as the sides below them aren't exactly firing on all cylinders. So they should be cautiously optimistic about making the top three, I think.
Well, this is the interesting point now. Andreas, well, there are a couple of interesting points about this Monaco side. One is, for the first time in a long time, we're not only talking about Wissam Ben Yedder. I know Golovin had a good season last year as well, but, you know, it's always, for the last, as long as I can remember, four, five seasons, it's been Wissam Ben Yedder, the player that's really driven this Monaco side with his goals. That's not the case this year. Andreas, you said, you know, that we expect Brest to finish in the top three now. It's almost done. But are Monaco going to pip them to that second place? I mean, they're the bigger team. It's what everyone really expects deep down.
You would. I mean, at the start of the season, very few people have thought Brest would be above Monaco. What I would say, and I know you're going to talk about it later, Rob, is Monaco's run-in. Well, the next few games is really tough for them. They've got Lille and they've got Brest, and then it finishes with some definitely winnable games. So it's going to be really close. It's going to be very interesting. I mean, Lille were my tip right back in August, and so I'll stick with them because I saw a lot of them last year, and I thought they played some really good football. So it's going to be very close. But look, Brest have got to be in the box position. Monaco, as Baptiste was saying, they've just sorted out their defence, where it's improved because they were leaking in so many goals earlier in the season. And their standout player for me has been Golovin. You know, he's really gone up a level this season. He's been making goals, scoring goals, a real leader, and playing in lots of different positions as well. I've seen him in midfield, Golovin. So he's having the best season, certainly, of his Ligue 1 career so far. And Monaco got a real chance of being in the top three.
All right. Well, since you're bigging up your pre-season prediction of Lille, let's chat LOSC and dogs. Big one was the 2-1 win over Lens in the derby. Edon Jegrova. He's a quality player, Jegrova. He's got that little bit extra, doesn't he? We will talk about, because this was two big games for them against Marseille, and it doesn't matter where Marseille are on the table. It's a little bit like Olympic Lyonnais. It's still a big game on the calendar. This exists in every league around the world, even if, you know, your Inter or your Napoli are doing badly. It's still a big game. Your Juve. This is the case in France with Lyon and Marseille. Used to be the case with Paris Saint-Germain, who are now always near the top of the table. But in the old days when we were growing up, Paris was always a big game, even if it wasn't a big game, even if the 3 points were not necessarily that hard to come by. But this was a big 2 weeks either side of the international break, Andreas, for Lille. And they came through in shining colours.
Well, the last two games they've had have been Friday night kickoffs, home against Lens, remember, the week before that, and then Marseille. So they're really two big, big games for the fans, Lens and Marseille. They beat them both. And we said it in the last couple of pods, Jonathan David, who had a really slow start to the season, he's been fantastic since the winter break. I think he may be the top scorer, but you know, he's just scoring goals for fun. He was brilliant against Marseille, made a penalty, scored a penalty. And it's just that confidence. You know, we said it before, but it is true. When a striker has confidence, it's so important. And Jonathan David, now he's playing like he can do anything. He can win a game on his own, and he often does. Again, we'll talk about this later, but Lille do have the little matter of Europe, don't they, to contend with as well. But they're hitting their stride. They had quite a lot of injury problems early in the season, which are sorting themselves out. So, yeah, they'll be going full of confidence. And look, if you're beating Lens and Marseille at home, the fans up in Lille are going to be really happy about that.
Absolutely. No, we know that Lille are a side that when things come together, every couple of seasons, they can really do something special. It looks as though, if not, if this season's going to be a little bit too late, if they can hold on, they're probably going to lose Jonathan David or David, depending on which side of Canada you're from. But it could be that maybe this is the good season they're having, depending on where they finish. Baptiste, Nice are down to fifth, just 1 point above Lens now. They've only had one win in their last 9 matches, 5 losses. Les Aiglons have had their wings clipped by no one else other than themselves, really. It's like they've come back down to earth. They haven't been able to change their game. They haven't been able to deal with a drop in form. They lost to Nantes. Now they've drawn with Reims. I don't get the feeling there's pressure on Farioli just because they had such a fantastic start to the season. But we also know that Nice is an ambitious club. I think, did I read something about Thiago Motta waiting in the wings, or was that somewhere else concerning, might have been concerning another team? But Nice are not afraid to change coaches. You get the feeling when you hire someone like Farioli, you're going for the longer term. You're there to put things in place. But we know in recent seasons they've tried that and it hasn't worked out.
Yeah, and you would hope that he's given time. I think there was enough promise at the start of the season. But at the same time, not much has changed since the start of the season. By that, I mean their margin of error in the first half was already extremely small, and they were winning by the odd goal and with a strong defense, and that was it, really. They were playing really nice football doing that, and you know, they were very well organized, compact, and trying to play the right way all the way to the edge of the opponent's box, basically. But they just didn't have the cutting edge. And I think what we found in 2024 is that margin for error has dwindled, and when that's happened, they've struggled to find a solution. And I think that's the criticism of Farioli at the moment, is he hasn't been able to find a solution, and his team always plays the same way, and there's nothing. And I'm not saying so he needs to change things tactically necessarily, but the enthusiasm remains the same, the directives remain the same, and they get stuck in that rut. Attacking wise, I mean, you can't cater either for Jeremy Boga missing an absolute sitter at the weekend. There's no, you know, what can Farioli do about that? But I think that's the criticism that's aimed at him, and I think it's not unfair criticism. Having said that, he's a young manager. They're still going to be top 8, close to top 6, which, frankly speaking, is where I know they're ambitious, but that's where their squad should be. When you look at the quality of the other sides. And so I suppose he's doing what's expected of him, but the first half of the season gave them hopes, and with that comes pressure. But I think he'll be given a bit more time. He'll be given at least a start for the first half of next season, I'd expect.
Well, there are a few sides down in this sort of part of the table, just above the soft stomach of the league, as we love to say in France. Andreas Lens are in sixth place, with Paris Saint-Germain in the final of the Coupe de France and favourites. It looks like, you know, seventh place could even be a ticket into Europe via the back door. But did we expect Lens to be struggling this much? Lens, that loss to Lille, yes, a loss in the derby can happen. That's understandable. But then drawing with Le Havre, who are a side who have struggled to take that next step up, who have come up from the second division, yes, with lots of courage, yes, with lots of, you know, effort and desire at the start of the season, but they've had a reality check in the second half of the campaign. And Lens were playing Champions League football. Lens were the revelation of the last two seasons in France. If they miss out on Europe, this is a big blow to their project, I reckon.
I think it's a very big blow, because they're counting on that that European prestige and the European finances coming in, because they've got 50 million coming in this year from a Champions League, which for a club like Lens is a really big amount of money to come in. And hands up, I thought Eli Wahi would be scoring more goals than he did. He was unlucky at the weekend. He whacked the bar with a shot. But I've got to say that, I mean, Lens were winning. I don't like to criticise referees, but it was a horrible decision. The Havre's penalty. I think it was Aguiar, just went up for a header, won a header, and the Le Havre player, Sabi, just went down. And it's kind of a bit of a beef with me. It's soft
because
penalties.
Because the Le Havre player was backing in, wasn't he?
Yeah, I mean, the penalties...
That was the thing.
Penalties got to be... I saw recently 15% of games are decided on penalties, the result of them, you know, who wins, loses, and draws. 90% of penalties are scored. If you give a penalty, it's really got to be for a clear foul, and I thought Lens were unlucky there. But to get you back to your question, you know, they've got this final part of the season to get into the top six and top seven. And a quick comparison with Nice, because we were talking about Nice's goals. I'm not a huge XG man, but I was looking at their XG. Nice are only 11th in terms of goals, and they underperform that 11th by more than any other team apart from Clermont. So what I'm getting at is they don't create many chances, Nice, and even the ones they create, they don't score. And Baptiste is absolutely right. I mean, Bogger's miss was horrible. Lens are a lot further up, and they're missing chances. So most coaches will say it's better to be creating chances and missing than not creating them at all. So for that reason, I'm a little bit more optimistic about Lens. But they've really got a lot of work to do. They've got to win most of their games now between now and May, Robbie.
Baptiste, a team that isn't winning a whole lot of matches at the moment but is still climbing the table, is Reims. They're up to seventh. They've climbed above Marseille and Rennes courtesy of their defeats. Obviously, that means it's very, very close. But Reims drew with Lyon, now drew with Nice scoreless. They're up to 40 points. They're in seventh place. And producer Stephen has put in here, are Reims trying to do a Stephen Bradbury? Now, this is an Australian sporting reference. Do either of you two, or I suspect any of our listeners, know what this is?
Yes.
Andreas does.
That's a sports
trivia. Oh, you both do.
Back in the day, Robbie, at Eurosport, obviously when I was at Eurosport, a short track skating was a big deal. And I still actually do like the sport a lot. It's one of my favorite winter sports. And there was this Australian who was last. There's four people racing in short track, and the other three just banged into each other right at the end, leaving Bradbury, is it Bradbury, to just glide over the line and get the gold medal in the Olympics, even though he was like the slowest skater because the others banged into each other, which is, it's definitely worth looking at that on YouTube. Really funny, even if you don't like short track skating.
Exactly. Brilliant. And I think for many Australians, it was a reinforcement of our national identity. That we can be hopeless at something, but just the fact that we will, you know, if we treat it the right way with the you know, go there with an open spirit, you never know, everyone might just fall over and we will win. The beauty of it was he did it in the quarterfinals and the semifinals as well, because he just wasn't good enough. He wasn't fast enough. And I actually saw, I think it was an American-Japanese skater was the favorite, maybe someone like Ono or something. Anyway, I can't remember the name, but Bradbury, actually, because all Olympic athletes are basically amateurs because there's not enough money in your sport, particularly if you're probably an average short tracks ice skater, which is what he was. He made ice skates. He made the skates, and he said to the favorite of the final, when you go up, make sure you've got my skates around your neck when you go up to get your medal, because I'm in the race, so you're assured of getting a medal. Make sure you take my skates up so that you do a good advertisement for it. And in the end, he literally rides across the finish line with the other three sprawled across the ice at his feet on the final corner. So Reims, Baptiste, could they do a Stephen Bradbury by just drawing their way through while those above them eat each other, if you like, and just prevent each other from doing it? Because we know that this Reims side has qualities, that they can be there, even though really qualifying for Europe is a big step for this club.
It is a big step, and it has felt a little bit stagnant over the last few weeks at Reims. And you always wonder whether Will Steele's visibility, the suitors that he's had, whether that's also taken a bit of a shine off what is still a very good season for them. You know, they're in the running for European places, and if you manage expectations properly, that's quite an achievement for a side like Reims. So I think their dynamic has been a bit hit and miss over the last few weeks, and it does feel a little bit like they're lacking a bit of creativity. I mean, I'm a huge fan of some of their attacking players. Junior Ito in particular, I think, is a delight. But they have felt... they have felt a little bit sluggish and tired. Having said that, you know, we've talked about Marseille and Rennes behind them are not exactly on their best behavior. and with the best results. Lyon are maybe coming in back relatively strongly.
Let's talk about Olympique Lyonnais then. Mm. This is the moment, because can they keep going? They defeated Nantes in the final match of the round. They were trailing in an empty Bourgeois. They managed to find the three goals midway through the second half that got them across the line. And they have, I mean, they were halfway through the season sitting in the bottom two. They are eating up coaches, going through things, controversy, no money. It was looking like a disastrous season. Everyone thought they've got to come good at some point. They are. Just how good can they come?
Well, Pierre Sage has done an outstanding job, really. I think you could tell yesterday, as their second and third goals came in, the reaction from the bench, there was a unity there that, frankly, I haven't seen at Lyon for a long time. And I think he's just made the culture at the club much healthier. He's obviously been backed by John Textor, and I think Textor does deserve a bit of credit for financing the acquisition of the likes of Malik Fofana, Gift mm-hmm. Orban, Nemanja Matic, who I imagine is on quite high wages for Liga and is a gamble. But it's working, and I think you see some togetherness there and a positive dynamic. They were found out a couple of weeks ago when they played against Lens, and you saw the difference between a well-established, well-settled team that's used to playing together against a mix of players who are just sort of being thrown in by circumstance. But Pierre Sage is learning. His substitutions had a real effect yesterday. And he's created that, he's fostered that team spirit. So, you know, they're always on the verge of collapse at some points in games, and you can feel they're two bad results away from another crisis, but they're looking up, which is an achievement in itself.
At the other end of the standings, Montpellier made it back-to-back wins. They got up over Le Havre 2-0 and then followed that up with a 2-0 win over Lorient. Importantly, in these types of results, these are games against direct rivals who are also trying to avoid the drop. So Montpellier have leapt up to 13th place. We may chat relegation zone a little bit more in 2 weeks' time when we come back. But at the moment, it's still looking not good for Metz and Clermont. They are at the foot of the table. Clermont have 21 points, Metz 23. They're the bottom two going down. Lorient are in 16th place on 26 points. Nantes are next up on 28 points. And that is, you know, Le Havre, 28 points. I don't know if Montpellier now, 9 points clear of Metz in 17th. They must think they're just about there. There's 6 games left to play. 9 points is a good little cushion to be enjoying at this stage. If you want to check out the highlights of all the highlights of Ligue 1, don't forget our YouTube channel at Ligue 1. Uber Eats for a little bit longer, I stress. We chatted about that recently. For all your match highlights, top goals, compilations, behind-the-scenes footage each week, you can check it out in English, or if you're an English fan of Ligue 1 looking to practice your French, just click it onto French. I remember I tried to, well, being a sports fan, and trying to learn French and Italian, football was always the best way. So get onto that, listen to it in French, and you know, you may be parlaying français in no time. The guys doing the highlights do an amazing job. They're online just a few hours after the match. So subscribe, get notified as soon as something drops. Okay, we're at the pointy end of Europe, but before we get there, we're at the pointy end of the Coupe de France, the French Cup. Olympique Lyonnais defeated Valenciennes by 3-0. A double from Lacazette went a long way to deciding this one. Lyon fans were obviously over the moon. Full-scale pitch invasion at the final whistle. They last made the final in 2012, Baptiste. This is almost inespéré, an unhoped-for opportunity to get silverware this season. Are they really any chance?
Well, who knows?
Anything can happen. It's one game. Exactly.
Exactly. Anything can happen. The usual disclaimers for making what would otherwise be a quite a confident prediction. But I think PSG are going to be a step too far. Again, you know, I mentioned the last game, they were played off the park, really. And even against Nantes, they showed some weaknesses in periods during the game. And I think once you're going to face a team like PSG, who are looking, I know they drew against Clermont, but they're looking very sharp. And especially for the big games in France, they have tended to turn up over the last few years. I think, you know, the safest prediction, and probably the correct one, is to say that PSG will win it. And I'd expect relatively, you know, comfortably, like a 2-0 would be my prediction.
Yeah, I tend to agree. The final will be played on the 25th of May at the Stade Pierre Mauroy, or the Decathlon Arena, as it has since been named, in Lille. Andreas, you've been keeping a close eye on PSG, of course. They defeated Marseille 2-0 after the international break. Vitinha and Ramos, Vitinha, who was outstanding and is outstanding more and more often in this Paris Saint-Germain side. And then the draw, 1-1 with Clermont, a little bit controversial. We mentioned it a couple of moments earlier, but Paris Saint-Germain went with what you call a change squad. They were behind for a long time in this match. In the end, it was Ramos, Gonçalo Ramos, from a Kylian Mbappe assist that got the late leveler. What did you make of their recent form, and in respect to the cup as well, because there was that cup victory that got them through by a 2-0 over Rennes? Do we expect Paris Saint-Germain to have cup number 15 in their cabinet soon?
Yeah, I agree with Baptiste. I think they'll be up for the big game. It will be the last game of the domestic season. They'll have their full team out for that, no doubt, and they will be up for that. I think the only way Lyon can win is if they really win ugly, if they somehow manage to just stop PSG playing, which I don't think they'll be able to do. In terms of PSG's form, Marseille was a good result because they went down to 10 men. Beraldo, very unlucky. It's one of those decisions. It's like, come on. He was unlucky to get a second yellow
for
that.
I thought that was a crazy decision.
I mean, it's really just part of football.
It was never a red card offence. I understand that it was potentially a second yellow, except that it wasn't. It was a straight red card,
yes.
Wasn't it?
Yeah.
There was no violence. It was on the touchline. It was shoulder to shoulder. It was a footballing challenge. But anyway,
exactly.
Let's not dwell.
From the positive point of view, they went and they won 2-0. Mbappe was substituted quite early in the second half. But Vitinha, for me, is the most improved player in that PSG team. He's really central to that team this season, Vitinha. Clermont, it's quite hard to judge because it was a reserve team. And I think we know who's going to play against Barcelona. We'll just see who didn't play against Clermont. Nevertheless, the goalkeeper, yeah, Tenas played. It was a passive display, let's put it that way. They never were really up for it. They didn't really show that aggression. Look, first Clermont, all credit for them. They parked the bus, but they played very intelligently. They didn't give away any yellow cards. They only gave away 7 fouls in the whole game. They got a bit lucky with the goal. If they show that kind of fight, maybe they've got a chance of staying up. We should have a quick word for Marquinhos, 435 games, equaling the club record for PSG. So, you know, well done, Marquinhos, and maybe we'll talk about him on another pod, but he's up on 435 and no doubt will get 436 very quickly. It's just hard to draw any real conclusions from that game. Mbappe came on very quiet. Marquinhos came on as well. I just think it's going to be a completely different team for the big games. And Luis Enrique, he's just lucky enough to be able to play a reserve team. So I wouldn't draw too many conclusions from Clermont, but it wasn't a great night at the office for PSG.
Let's have a little chat, Marquinhos, because I was at PSG when he signed as a young 19-year-old from AS Roma with braces on his teeth and terrible skin, literally just a kid learning his trade. He used to get nutmegged all the time in that first season and give away penalties. I remember it very clearly, playing second fiddle. It was Alex and Thiago Silva at the time, two Brazilians that he looked up to very much. Then Alex moved on. We had David Luiz at one point, and slowly Marquinhos was thinking, okay, sooner or later, this is going to be me in this position. He did get his chance in the end alongside Thiago Silva. 435 matches for Paris Saint-Germain. I thought Marco Verratti was going to get there probably ahead of him. That didn't happen, Baptiste. Where do we put Marquinhos in the history of Paris Saint-Germain, because football has changed so much. Jean-Marc Piloget was the former captain who was there from 1975 to 1992 and came back from knee reconstructions back when it was difficult to do that, and still played and played all these matches. He was a one-club man, Piloget. Where does Marquinhos sit then in the history of Paris Saint-Germain? Because this is a club that have struggled in the past to honour its legends of more recent times, including a top scorer, Edinson Cavani, for example.
Yeah, and I think he might not get the recognition he actually deserves, because you can't, 435 games and counting is an impressive feat. And he's been loyal. He's been a good representative for the club. He speaks fluent French. Mm. He doesn't hide, in interviews. He's very clear in his communication and humble. And he's somebody who you would want as the representative of your club. I think, unfortunately for him, he plays in a position which is less glamorous than other positions. He's also associated with some big defeats, as is Thiago Silva. But Marquinhos is maybe a symbol of that mental frailty, fairly or unfairly. And then even just in terms of at PSG, he's not even the most recognizable Brazilian in their history, I suppose, right? You're looking at the likes of Rai, Leonardo going back. Obviously, Ronaldinho. And then more recently, obviously, non-Brazilians, but I think people like Zlatan Ibrahimovic had such an outsized impact at the club that I think people appreciate him, but don't necessarily give him the credit that he's due, because he's very professional. He seems like a really good guy, and he looks after himself really well. But for all these reasons, I think he's not going to get... Yeah, I don't think he's going to get the recognition that somebody of his ilk deserves, really.
Well, I mean, not many people know who Jean-Marc Piloget is either. It's not necessarily your all-time leading appearance maker who had to be your number one star player, but there should be a special place for them, shouldn't there? And I can talk all day about my experiences at Paris Saint-Germain, but Marquinhos is just a good guy. He really is just a great guy. He's, as you say, he's very humble. What you see from the outside is how it is on the inside as well. He's a very generous, I think he's a very gentle man as well. He's always puts his kids to the forefront. He's been a great support to his partner, who's a singer and performer in France nowadays as well. Yeah, he's just a good guy. I remember, when I left Paris Saint-Germain, he was the only player that came up to me in a game after a match and came up to me and said, "I hear you're leaving. Thank you, thank you for everything. We've been, my first season at the club was his first season at the club. I must have interviewed him, 200 times." And it sounds weird to people when you think, "Oh, but you were there for 10 years with him." But, it's still strange to think that you could have a bond with, the Brazil captain, and he comes up to you and says at the end, "It was great working with you. Just thought, I wish you all the best for the future moving forward." Funnily enough, it's something that Thiago Silva also had. It's a human quality that I guess means that when you lose, people call you frail because you're not a machine, and you don't have this ego that can repel everything like some sort of force field around you. You have human qualities, and perhaps we could celebrate them more in football than we do the bravado and the, you have to be strong. Obviously, you have to be strong to make it. But he's a really, really good guy, really good guy. And I hope the club do. I'm sure they will, because I'm sure he will always do the right thing by the club as well. So I'm sure there will be a good relationship there moving forward. Next up, we have one of our special features, because we've just spoken about the Coupe de France final, Paris Saint-Germain versus Olympique Lyonnais, the two most successful Ligue 1 sides of the 21st century. They're facing off in the Coupe de France final. They're also facing off in Ligue 1 round 30. It will be more hotly contested than ever, because it's not only a dress rehearsal for the cup final on May 25th. It's a massive match of football. And our man, Jonathan Johnson, who spoke to us about this fixture coming up and being one to keep an eye on, well, we've asked him to put together this preview for us. So take it away, JJ.
Paris Saint-Germain versus Olympique Lyonnais, a fixture so big and steeped in French football history that we're going to be treated to two helpings of it between now and the end of the season. First of all, there's the Ligue 1 meeting between the pair in the French capital later this month, before the season-ending Coupe de France final matchup, which will take place in Lille. Traditionally one of the biggest encounters on the domestic calendar in any given year, and generally, regardless of form, this is France's most populous city, Paris, up against its third biggest, Lyon. Over the years, this has been a battle not only with consequences at the top end of the championnat table, but also between two of the most prolific youth development powerhouses. Kylian Mbappe versus Alexandre Lacazette will make the headlines, with both personifying the best that Paris and Lyon-based talent can offer. However, this fixture has also boasted the likes of Karim Benzema in years gone by, while Bradley Barcola recently crossed the PSG-OL divide, like others including Hatem Ben Arfa before him. This year has more of a French feel to it than ever after PSG's overhaul, which saw the likes of Ousmane Dembele, Lucas Hernandez and Randall Kolo Muani join Mbappe and Warren Zaïre-Emery in Paris. Most striking about this fixture, though, is the sheer size and power of these two genuine domestic giants. Between them, PSG and Lyon have 18 Ligue 1 titles, with the capital outfit boasting 11 of those to OL's 7. Number 12 would obviously move a step closer with a win here. Although those 7-4 Lyon did all come consecutively, which is something that Paris has not yet managed to replicate. Also, looking ahead to the Coupe de France final, these two account for a collective 19 titles, with 14 of those PSG's, a national record, like their Ligue 1 tally of 11, ahead of OL's bitter rival Saint-Étienne on 10. Factor in that there have been two cup finals in the Coupe de la Ligue between these two since PSG's Qatari takeover. Les Rouges et Bleus won the 2014 and the last ever 2020 editions before its retirement as France's second domestic club competition. And this matchup has produced many memorable games over the years, with one particularly thrilling 4-4 draw in Lyon back in 2012, which ultimately played a part in PSG failing to win the Ligue 1 title in Qatar's first season of ownership. OL are in recovering form, but it might not be enough to get the now American-backed club back into Europe via the league. This Coupe de France final could be Lyon's best route back onto the continental scene, thanks to a fascinating subplot across these two games. PSG win in the Coupe de France adds an extra European place to the final Ligue 1 standings, which would mean that 7th position would be enough for Lyon. OL are currently 2 points away from 7th, so all might not be lost by the time that the final arrives, which of course takes place after the final Ligue 1 games have been played. Therefore, even a loss for Lyon might not necessarily mean missing out on the UEFA Europa League next season. It finished 4-1 to PSG earlier this term, so hopefully we're set for a pair of tighter encounters this time. But make no mistake, this is one of France's leading domestic rivalries, which could be about to enter a new era of competition between these two.
Okay, so thank you to CBS Viacom's man in Paris, Jonathan Johnson, for that preview. Andreas, it's a big game. Paris Saint-Germain will be coming off the back of their Champions League quarterfinal, hopefully into the semifinals against either Dortmund or Atletico, I think it is. So that's going to be, they're in the good side of the draw in that one. We'll chat about that in a moment's time. But what do you see happening here? Olympique Lyonnais would have sat back, will have watched that, will be rearing, full of energy and ready to turn back the clock, I guess, a little bit, back to their glory days when they used to be able to mix it with Paris Saint-Germain and beat them most of the time back in the early noughties.
Yeah, they have had a couple of recent wins, or one recent I remember at PSG, but this season they were absolutely hammered, and Kylian Mbappe scored 12 career goals, I think, against Lyon. He likes playing against Lyon. No, it's going to be, the atmosphere is going to be completely dependent on that Barcelona match, isn't it? Because that's what happens with PSG. If they've beaten Barcelona, the club is going to be on a huge high. There'll be confidence. If the worst happens, I don't want to think about what kind of atmosphere there'll be at the Parc des Princes. I think in either case, PSG will put out a strong team because they would have had that Champions League match behind them, and I expect them to probably get a win. Although Lyon have been fantastic away, you know, Robbie. They've won 5 matches away on the bounce. And that's really where this this improvement of form has come from. But I think whatever happens in the Champions League, you've got to say PSG are favourites for that match.
Baptiste, you were one that grew up to the rhythm of Olympique Lyonnais flying the French flag and Paris Saint-Germain, much derided. Is this does this one bring back a bit of nostalgia every time it swings by on the calendar, or are those years gone now?
Yeah, well, yeah, you know, I think when they were on a high, Lyon, they were on a real high, and they were very much the PSG of the noughties. They were so, you know, they were borderline unbeatable, and I think they enjoyed their time against PSG between 2001 and 2008, much as PSG have been enjoying the sort of last 8 or 9 years. So it's a role reversal slightly. What I'll be looking out for in this game is what side Pierre Sage puts out, because I agree with Andreas that I think PSG will treat this fixture with the respect it deserves, and whether they have a good outcome or a negative outcome in the Champions League, they will put out a strong side. But with Pierre Sage and Noël, they've mixed it between a 3-5-2 and a 4-3-3, and I think there are some, not just tactical, but in terms of personnel choices, it'll be interesting to see who he goes with, because my mind, the Corentin Tolisso experiment has utterly failed, and I struggle to see what he brings to the pitch every weekend. But he's in a high-stakes game with the experience he has and the personality that he has and the leadership that he may have. Sage might be tempted to start him. So it will say a lot, I think, for me as to how Pierre Sage sees his squad and sees his team with the first 11 that he'll pick. And I'm hoping he'll be bold and reward some players who have perked up recently, like Malik Fofana and Ryan Cherki, who came on yesterday and actually played football in a much, much simpler way. And when he does that, you can see what the hoopla about him is, but he tends to overcomplicate and overfrustrate anyone. So I'd be intrigued by that pick. But I think, you know, I mean, I gave him a 2-0 win in the Coupe de France. I'm not seeing a much different result, I think, in the league.
All right. You're listening to a very honest Baptiste Reynaud of Le Classique Pod and Andreas Evagora, Ligue 1 and PSG TV commentator. Next up, we're going to talk European football. So Paris Saint-Germain take on Barcelona. These two just can't get enough of each other. They've played 13 times in Europe. Perhaps most importantly, it was a final of the Cup Winners' Cup back in 1997 when a certain Ronaldo scored the only goal of the game from the penalty spot. It was the end of an era for Paris Saint-Germain. They'd won the Cup Winners' Cup the season before against Rapid Vienna. This was their time. They had a fantastic side. The Rai, Leonardo, George Weah, the famous French players, Roche, Lama, Guérin, Le Guen, Bravo. Brilliant, brilliant. Well, they had all sorts of players. For Loco was there as well. Ginola, Fournier, I can keep going. I will stop. It was a very good Paris Saint-Germain side, and it was their first golden age, because we often forget that when we think about the Paris Saint-Germain as it is now. Since then, Barcelona have also grown in status under the guidance first of, you know, back then in the 90s of Johan Cruyff, then his disciples. Barcelona became a different side, and they're pretty much had the wood over Paris Saint-Germain. Baptiste mentioned it earlier, some searing defeats that Marquinhos has been. Whenever I hear that sort of reference, I immediately think to that night and the 6-1, obviously, which is a bit of PTSD that I think lots of Paris Saint-Germain fans and people that were there that night suffer from. It was a remarkable evening. There was some revenge the last time we played them. I think Kylian got a hat-trick in Barcelona, a 4-1 win. I was there that night as well. Messi scored a fantastic goal at the park after that in a 1-1 draw before coming to join the obviously stronger of the two clubs moving forward. That was back in 2021. Now the stage is set for another meeting Baptiste. Obviously, I've just said there's history between these two sides in Europe, history that can never be erased. Thank you, Deniz Aytekin, the German referee of that 6-1 as well, whose name I will never forget and who Paris Saint-Germain fans' name will never forget either. Baptiste, let's forget all that. It's a new dawn. We're not looking for revenge. We're moving forward. This is one game at a time. This Barcelona side, who are starting to find a little bit of form against Paris Saint-Germain, they're on the good side of the draw, as we mentioned a few moments earlier. The winner will play either Atletico Madrid or Borussia Dortmund. What do you think is going to happen in this two-legged quarterfinal tie?
I think both clubs are coming into it with a good dynamic, but I think PSG will be thinking that Barcelona are vulnerable and that they're actually the favourites. And I don't think that's unwarranted. They've got the better manager of the two. They've got, you know, probably the best player on the pitch in Kylian Mbappe. And I think they have found a formula now at PSG. You mentioned Vitinha, Andreas, earlier on the pod, and I think he's been outstanding, not just the most improved player in Ligue 1, but one of the very best there. And he's found a formula for his midfield at PSG. So I think they'll be going into it very, you know, confidently. And I would expect them to beat Barcelona. I think I'm feeling very bullish with my predictions today, yeah, but I think absolutely. I know. What am I doing? The first rule. First rule is not to be confident in your predictions, but you know, they've impressed me more and more, PSG, as the season's gone along. Actually, you can tell how Luis Enrique's built his side. He's rebuilt the midfield. He's focused on possession, but I think they've had a cutting edge, actually, apart from the game against Clermont where they were disinterested. They've had a cutting edge in their game, and you know the pressure being put on Mbappe and the Ramos revival, if I can put it that way, because he wasn't really given a lot of chances, means that he has a lot of weapons at his disposal, and he'll be going in there with a lot of confidence.
Andreas, they have, and how much can we read into the fact that it's Luis Enrique, who of course was the coach that famous night of the 6-1 victory of Barcelona? He's a Barcelona legend who's going back now. There are the questions in every press conference now about, would you go back and coach? Xavi's leaving. Are you going to be the next Barcelona coach? Oh, I've got to cut. I mean, it's incredible the way these questions come up. Paris Saint-Germain are now going to be linked with Barcelona players. How much can we read into that fact that Luis Enrique is the coach of Paris Saint-Germain against Barcelona? And also that Kylian Mbappe is going to Real Madrid, Barcelona's sworn enemy, and here he is with Paris Saint-Germain, the chance to land an early blow. Are these just journalistic narratives that we're reading into it, and should we be really concentrating on the nitty-gritty of where Warren Zaïre-Emery is going to play with Vitinha in this side? Does Ugarte get a recall? Who's going to be the front three? Ousmane Dembele against Barcelona as well. I mean, there are subplots, there are nostalgic stories, there are angles, but essentially this is a high, high level football match between two very good sides.
Yeah, I think the Mbappe story is going to have absolutely no impact on the game. Whoever PSG are playing, Kylian Mbappe is going to give everything. He's not going to try more or less because of Real Madrid. I think Luis Enrique is very different because he knows Barcelona inside out. And there might be some little details. There will be stuff that he probably knows about Barcelona that maybe other coaches don't. So I do think he's not going to be trying any more or less, but he just knows the club. You know, he knows the players. He'll just know things that,
the coach.
As a coach, but he'll just know those little things. Maybe a player has a slight weakness here or there, which can make a difference in what's going to be a close match. What I do think will be really important is Dembele, and you touched on it, because Dembele has played through the centre. He played against Real Sociedad. He played through the centre. I remember when I was commentating that, I was thinking, well, I haven't seen that for a while. I mean, he has played through the centre. He played at Dortmund. He played behind Aubameyang. And I think at Rennes, he kind of played there a little bit, didn't play much at Rennes
when
before
he first came,
but
when he first
I was
started.
Really impressed with him, Robbie. I got to say, I think he can definitely play in that position as sort of number 10, whatever you want to call it, but centrally. Luis Enrique, he's not one to talk to the press too much. He doesn't really, you know, he talks, but, you know, not in the full sense of the word.
He doesn't rate the press.
He doesn't like talking to journalists, let's put it that way. But he was asked about Dembele, about this logic, and he said, look, Dembele is one of our best players. I want him to be as close as possible to getting into a dangerous part of the pitch, and I want him to have as many touches as possible, hence putting him through the centre. Now, what that changes is, earlier in the season, Dembele worked really well with Hakimi. That was one of the best things about PSG earlier on in the season, because it wasn't just about going through Mbappe. So they lose something there. I'm going to be fascinated to see when Dembele plays. And I think that could be a key factor. If he plays through the centre, then I imagine Lee will go down the right. He'll be hugging the touchline. And how he works with Hakimi is going to be interesting. So I think they're some of the big things to look out for. But look, Barcelona. I think people are an easier side of the draw, but they're second in La Liga. They've won four in their last five games. Mm-hmm. I haven't seen much of Lamine Yamal apart from a few highlights here and there, but you know, they're saying that, I don't want to say the next Messi because that's a daft thing to say, but you know, he's getting this huge build-up. So I'm fascinated to see how this 16-year-old plays. And a last quick word, I think they're better off starting at home, because what they maybe lack in Liga is a team really going at them and real intensity. And if Barcelona sit back in the first half, I think that will suit PSG perfectly well. So let's see how things work out. But I would say PSG are slight favourites.
It's going to be a fantastic tie in the quarterfinals. I mean, it's great that Paris Saint-Germain are back in the quarterfinals of this competition already, to have this interest in the club that's leading Ligue 1, that's probably almost certainly, well, is going to be crowned champions at the end of the season in Ligue 1. It's great to see them at the quarterfinals of the competition, and massive, massive two matches coming up against Barcelona. Lille are also there, Baptiste. They're taking on Aston Villa. There's a little French connection there with Unai, who's been doing wonders at Aston Villa as well, taking on Lille. First leg in Birmingham on Thursday, the 11th of April. Second leg back in Lille on the 18th, a week later. This is going to be a big test, very big test for Lille. Aston Villa, as English clubs in Europe these days do, start favourites. The financial clout, the quality of the squads, the everything about these clubs when they come, and it doesn't have to be in the Champions League, probably less, even more emphatic when it's not in the Champions League, when it's in the Europa League or the Conference League. These English sides really do pack a punch at this level in European competition. Can Lille match it with Aston Villa?
It is a mountain to climb, I think, especially in Europe with Unai Emery, who's done outstanding at Villa, who's been backed as well. Let's be honest as well. You know, they've invested a lot of money in that club, and they've bought some really good players as a result. So, you know, the talent is there, and they're really well managed. So I think it is a mountain to climb for Lille. Especially as, you know, Paulo Fonseca, I think we've touched upon it, he's done an outstanding job. And when you look at where some of those players have come from, I mean, his back four at the weekend was Lenny Yoro, who's 18, Alexandro, who was in third division in Brazil less than a year ago, Thiago Santos, who moved from Portugal, with all due respect to, I think he was in Portugal, was it Estoril, or and Ismaili, who pretty much came on a free, you know, so... He's working. I'm not saying he's working miracles, because he's had some investment in Ligue 1 for Ligue 1 standards, but in Europe it's going to be a real step up, and their path there hasn't been the smoothest either. They've really struggled against smaller clubs than Villa, so they really have to step up. So it feels like a step too far for them, but I think they will surprise. You know, if he puts out his strongest teams, I think the likes of Jegrova, Angel Gomez, obviously Jonathan David, and people would get another glimpse of Remy Kabila, who was forgotten by most English fans, I imagine. And they'll be surprised at how good, how well managed and how well coached and that side is.
Yeah, Remy Kabila scored a fantastic goal against Marseille on Friday night as well. These two sides have met before. It was back in 2002 in the Intertoto Cup. A 1-1 draw in Lille and a 2-0 win for the Dogs. at Villa Park.
The Intertoad.
That was a different time, wasn't it, gentlemen? My goodness me. If they do get through, they'll be into the semi-finals against Fenerbahce against Olympiakos. Now that, at any time, is a mouth-watering matchup, but especially with Fenerbahce at the moment and what's going on in Turkish football, that's just completely crazy. We're not even going to go there. Andreas, next up, Marseille versus Benfica. Now this is a very historical tie. And I was just having a look preparing the pod, and I just saw the French authorities have said Benfica fans not so welcome at the moment. Benfica have announced on their official website a statement saying these are two great clubs with great history, great respect. We hope that Benfica fans will be able to travel to France and that Marseille fans will be able to travel to Portugal. What is this about? Do either of you two know the history of this? Because there is history between these two sides, and it goes back to the Champions League, a famous goal scored by Evata back in 1990 with his hand. It's famously punching the ball into the goal so that Benfica defeated Marseille in the semi-finals of the Champions League. Benfica went on to take on AC Milan, I think it was, in the final that year.
But yeah, that rankles.
Yeah.
Marseille fans still remember that. Look, these two clubs do have a great history. One other element is there's a sizable Portuguese community in France and around Marseille. So I think if we suddenly start saying no Benfica fans around Marseille, it's like sort of getting egg out of the pudding. You know, I mean,
it's not going to happen.
It's not going to happen. Yeah. And yeah, you're probably not going to stop Marseille fans getting on a flight to Lisbon either. But look, in terms of the football, Benfica they're second in Portugal. They lost at the weekend, big game of the weekend. They played Sporting and lost that one, so they're 4 points behind. They got a good scorer in Rafa. I mean, I've been told Benfica is still a really very good team by a colleague of mine who follows Portuguese football more than me. Marseille, though, I don't know. I think they've lost four on the bounce in Liga. I was a little bit pessimistic about them earlier in the season. And is it a case of the chickens coming home to roost? Because that manager bounced, didn't they? Which was great, and that got some results for them. I think this is going to be a tricky one for them, but they're not exactly going in full of confidence. But it's going to be, you know, their season's riding it, isn't it, on this game for Marseille. It doesn't look like they're going to be getting European place in Ligue 1 if things carry on as they are. So it's going to be a great spectacle. Great spectacle.
Yeah, two fantastic stadiums, two fantastic atmospheres as well. I mean, let's hope the fans get to travel, because the Velodrome in full voice is something to be seen. The Stade de Luge is really something special as well. The winner will take on the winner of Liverpool versus Atalanta as well in the semi-finals. So that's going to be a nice little reward for OM if they can get there. Now, part of getting there will almost certainly rely on the form of Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang. He's been firing in the goals, almost more so in Europe than he has in Ligue 1, but he's really continued to find some form. He's a player who's thrived at clubs where he's enjoyed the confidence of the coach, and he burst into form when Jean-Louis Gasset arrived at the helm of Olympique Lyonnais, Olympique Marseille, rather. Still plenty of challenges in store this season. Nonetheless, Aubameyang, he's got the skills, he's got the pedigree, he's got the experience to play a key role for Olympique de Marseille in Europe and in Ligue 1. And Andy Scott has more.
The sleepy town of Laval is a wholly unremarkable place, an occasional stop on the high-speed railway line between Paris and Rennes in a rural region, the Mayenne, which borders Normandy and Brittany, but is not part of either. There are more cows than people here, which helps explain why Laval is home to the headquarters of Lactalis, one of the biggest dairy companies in the world. The local football team, Stade Lavallois, have spent the last 30 years flitting between France's second and third tiers. They are currently competing for promotion to Ligue 1, though, and if they get there, it'd be the first time in the top flight for the Tangos since the late 1980s. Back then, their squad included a young Franck Leboeuf, appropriately, you might say, given the prevalence of cows in the region, and also a certain Pierre Aubameyang. It was in Laval in June 1989 that Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang, son of Gabon international Pierre, was born. Pierre-Emerick, whose mother was originally from Spain, followed his father around France as Aubameyang Sr. went on to play for clubs such as Le Havre and Nice, but he's always considered Laval to be home and goes back there as often as he can to get away from it all. Like his elder brothers, Catilina and Willy, and thanks to contacts of his father, Pierre-Emerick enjoyed a footballing education in the academy of the mighty AC Milan, a world away from provincial Laval. The teenage Aubameyang scored goals in the Milan youth team, but was unable to break into the first team. He was 19 when it was decided that he would return to France and go on loan to Dijon in Ligue 2 in the 2008-09 season. It was while there, in February 2009, that Aubameyang was capped by the France under-21 team, playing alongside the likes of Mamadou Sakho and Moussa Sissoko in a friendly against Tunisia. Although, soon after that, he committed his international future to Gabon, the country of his father's birth, for whom he's gone on to play in the Africa Cup of Nations several times. Another loan move followed in the next campaign, this time to Lille. This was the Lille of Rudy Garcia, featuring Eden Hazard, Gervinho, Yoann Cabaye, Adil Rami and more. The team that would go on to win a Ligue 1 and French Cup double the following season. Aubameyang made 24 appearances but only started 10 times and scored just 2 goals. He had guys like Gervinho and Hazard ahead of him in the pecking order, but at the age of 20, you could already see that he was going to be a very good player, coach Garcia recalled years later. Instead of staying in Lille to help them win the title, Aubameyang made another loan move, this time to Monaco. He started regularly and scored a couple of goals under coach Guy Lacan, who later described him as clumsy in front of goal. Lacan said he asked the club to sign Aubameyang permanently, though, but the board refused. In any case, by the time the striker left in January 2011, Monaco were in the relegation zone and they would go down at the end of the campaign. By which time, Aubameyang had already joined Saint-Étienne, a loan deal that soon became permanent. In Saint-Étienne in 2012, the great French club of years past were beginning an exciting new era under Christophe Galtier, with Aubameyang forming a fearsome attacking partnership with the experienced Brazilian striker Brandão. Between them, they scored 35 goals in the 2012-13 season. Aubameyang got 19 in Ligue 1, a tally bettered only by Paris Saint-Germain's new superstar, Zlatan Ibrahimovic. Saint-Étienne came fifth, equaling their best performance in quarter of a century. Most importantly, Saint-Étienne ended a trophy drought going back more than 30 years by beating Rennes 1-0 in the Coupe de la Ligue final. Aubameyang set up Brandao's winning goal that day, which left grown men in tears in the Saint-Étienne support at the Stade de France. Aubameyang turned 24 that summer and had clearly outgrown Levert, who sold him to Borussia Dortmund for an initial €13 million, the beginning of a decade outside France for Aubameyang. Dortmund had just lost that year's Champions League final to Bayern Munich. He struck up an exciting partnership with Robert Lewandowski, an attack ably supported by the likes of Marco Reus and Henrik Mkhitaryan. Jurgen Klopp's Dortmund nevertheless came a distant second in the Bundesliga to Bayern, who poached Lewandowski in the summer of 2014. And so Aubameyang became Dortmund's main man and reached his peak in the 2016-17 season when under Thomas Tuchel he netted 31 goals to finish as the Bundesliga's leading marksman. Aubameyang pulling on a Spider-Man mask to celebrate his goals became a common sight, a celebration initially meant as a tribute to goalkeeper Jeremy Jeannot, a teammate of his at Saint-Étienne. He also grabbed the winner for Tuchel's side in the German Cup final against Eintracht Frankfurt. That would be his one and only major trophy while with Dortmund. In January 2018, he was on the move again, signing for Arsenal for a club record fee of £56 million. Aubameyang scored on his debut for the Gunners and ended up as the Premier League's joint top scorer with 22 goals in his first full season with the club, when he also helped Unai Emery's team make it to the Europa League final. He matched that goal tally the following season and starred as Arsenal came out of the interruption to the campaign caused by the pandemic to win the FA Cup. Aubameyang got a brace as the Gunners beat Chelsea in the final at an empty Wembley. Yet his influence began to wane after that. In January 2022, he left North London and signed for Barcelona, finally fulfilling his dream of playing in Spain. Aubameyang immediately started banging in the goals in his side, enjoying a revival under Xavi Hernandez. including a double in a stunning 4-0 win away to Real Madrid in the Clásico. Yet he lasted little over 6 months in Catalonia before returning to the Premier League in September 2022, this time signing for Chelsea. There, he was reunited with Tuchel, his former coach at Dortmund, if only for a few days before the German was sacked by Chelsea's new owners. It was a turbulent time at Stamford Bridge, and Aubameyang was unable to settle. He managed just 5 Premier League starts and scored a single goal. Which brings us up to July 2023 and his return to Ligue 1. Aubameyang signed a 3-year deal at Marseille, and there he's flourished despite the scepticism, not least from members of this podcast, and the regular crises and changes of coach at the Velodrome. He saved his best form for the Europa League, becoming the all-time top scorer in that competition thanks to his 9 goals in 9 games on Marseille's run to the quarterfinals. The striker's form at OM shows there's plenty of life left in him yet, even as he prepares to turn 35 and might be beginning to make plans to retire back to sleepy Laval.
Baptiste, Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang. He came through the youth academy at AC Milan, where his dad, a former player, was, I think, the scout for Africa at AC Milan at the time. He got his kid into the academy. Not always a good sign when dad's pulling strings like that, but clearly he had some talent. He didn't make the grade as a kid at AC Milan. He rebounded in France in the second division, didn't he? And then went on. You know, it was hard to see where his career was going. And then suddenly at Saint-Étienne, he burst into life.
Yes, trusted by Christophe Galtier at Saint-Etienne, who, you know, stopped messing about with Aubameyang, I suppose. He'd been on loan a number of times, playing across the front three, you know, sometimes on the wing, rarely as a lone striker. At Saint-Etienne, that all changed, and he became the main striker for a really solid and successful side, actually, for a number of years. And I think he's, you know, he deserves a lot of credit for that transformation, because I remember his time at Lille in Monaco, and you felt like he would never be able to score no matter the number of chances that were given to him. And he transformed into one of the most lethal strikers in Europe. And he's been doing this across a number of clubs and in different contexts for more than a decade. And I think that's not always taken into account when, you know, when people look at Aubameyang and he's a bit flash and some of his behavior off the pitch is sometimes clouded his impact on it, but he's been really good at every club he's been at. He's scored a lot of goals. He's done what he's been asked of, and at Marseille, that's continued under Jean-Louis Gasset. And you can tell that European nights matter a lot to him. And what there's no easier way to get into Marseille fans' hearts than delivering on the European stage in big games.
Andreas, you will have watched him very, very closely. After leaving France, he went to Borussia Dortmund, of course, where he was truly outstanding. That earned him the big move to the English Premier League. Does he still have it? I mean, when he was younger, his pace was absolutely everything. That was the key to his whole performance. Once he found out where the goal was, and that took a couple of seasons, coupled with that pace, It was an unstoppable combination. Does he still have it for Marseille? I mean, we've seen he does have it at a certain level, but now we're getting into the rarefied atmosphere of the final eight in Europe, big matches. He hasn't been able to fire Marseille into the European places in Ligue 1. Can he do it on the continent?
Well, you're right to point to his pace. I was covering a lot of German football when he moved to Dortmund, and he was sensational. And what Dortmund managed to do was use that pace. They played a really, you may remember Dortmund, this is when he went there, they played a really fast, aggressive, open form of football. They were really popular around Europe. And he really made the most of that at Dortmund. And then when he went to Arsenal, what he has been criticised was some of his sort of, what, let's be honest, he's always late. That's what everyone says. He's late for meetings. And what Thomas Tuchel did, you know, famously in an interview, he basically said, look, if there's a meeting at 11, I'll tell him that it's at 10:30. And you'll hear that he's coming because he comes in such a loud, flashy car that you can hear him from like a kilometre away. That's Thomas Tuchel saying that, not me. But what everyone says, and I remember when I went to Dortmund quite a lot in that period and spoke to journalists, once he is on the training pitch, he's a consummate professional. and he's the last off the pitch. And so don't mistake that turning up a bit late and having a flashy car for not being a serious pro. He is. You wouldn't score that many goals if you were taking, you know, this sport lightly. And he's the top scorer ever in the Europa League. Does he still have it now? He's clearly lost a bit of pace, but I've been surprised with him and proved wrong, because I didn't think he scored too many goals this year. He's adapted his game a little bit to make the pace less important, but it's all about who he's playing with. And if he's going to score against Benfica, he's just going to have to be presented with chances, and you know that's there to be seen. But I agree with Baptiste. I think when the career of Aubameyang is written, he'll be, you know, one of the great strikers of his generation. Very popular player, scores spectacular goals, and by all accounts, a pleasure to play with.
I remember working with Thomas Tuchel and being astonished at the punctuality of people at Paris Saint-Germain as well, and saying, in Germany, if you say you have a meeting at 11 a.m., that means everyone is there at 10:55. That's what it means. And here people rock in already at 11, you're late in Germany. And so clearly, poor old Pierre-Emerick had to learn that the harsh way. You're listening to Le Beau Jeu, the official Ligue 1 Uber Eats podcast in English. Don't forget to also check out Ligue1.com for all your top flight news from France. There are highlights there, match previews, stories, features, everything more than you can poke a stick at, if poking sticks, of course, is something you do. Okay, folks, all you Ligue 1 trivia buffs, this is the moment you've been waiting for, the latest installment of Deja Who. Before we give you a chance to win a signed Terry Moffey jersey with our latest near impossible clue, I like to think. I do spend a lot of time coming up with these brain teasers. Before then, however, we do have a Teddy Tuma Reims jersey to give away. It's time to announce the winner. If you got Carlos Bianchi, it was one of the answers before the international break, or Grzegorz Krychowiak was the other one, then you went into the running. And I'm very pleased to say the winner of the Reims Teddy Tuma shirt is Sarah Gannett, or Sarah Gannet, perhaps, depending on where you're from in France. But at any rate, there we go. Sarah, we will be in touch. You get in touch. Your people can call our people. We'll organize for the sending out of that Teddy Tuma shirt. Congratulations. And now we are ready for our next clue. If you think you know the answer at the end of this Deja Who quiz, this Who Am I, send in your answers to us via email at League1podcast@gmail.com. So here we go. We are ready for the clue. Who am I? After winning three league titles in my homeland, I arrived in France to fill the boots of a club legend and future World Cup winner. Over the next six seasons, I played nearly 200 matches for my team before earning a move across the channel, where I won two FA Cups and a Community Shield before another move saw me claim the Coppa Italia. I've since moved on and I'm still playing, but one thing has remained constant. It's my love of the national team jersey, which I have worn more times than any other player. Who am I, and who was I signed to replace when I arrived in France? So there you go. There's the clue. If you know the answer, send it to League1podcast@gmail.com, and you will go into the running for a chance to win a signed Terry Moffey OGC Nice jersey. Got to be in it to win it. So if you think you know who it is, send your emails in. Don't forget, you're listening to Le Beau Jeu, the official Ligue 1 podcast. Thank you for supporting the podcast. Thank you for listening. If you're enjoying it, leave us a review on Spotify or Apple Podcasts, and tell your friends to start listening as well. Gentlemen, we're just about done. We're going to look ahead to the next two rounds, rounds 29 and 30 of the Ligue 1 season. In round 29, we've got Marseille versus Nice. Monaco versus Lille, Metz versus Lens as well, which could be a big impact on what happens perhaps in European places and certainly down below. Baptiste, what do you see in round 29 to catch your eye and that you think could have an impact on this incredibly tight European race and also relegation race?
I'm going to go for one related to relegation, but I'm really intrigued about Le Havre-Nantes that weekend, because that is Le Havre sliding down. Nantes looked pretty good previous week, and then in the first of hour against Lyon, they looked really solid, and always like a bit of Comboiré in Ligue 1. He's somebody who I have a lot of time for. He's a really likable guy. And so I think that will be a big, that is a relegation six-pointer, really, that weekend for both sides. So off the beaten path slightly, but that's one that I find intriguing. And I'll be intrigued to see how both teams play as well, whether it's just going to be really backs against the wall or there's going to be some ambition in the football.
Yeah, it's going to be a nice round of fixtures there. Andreas, the week after, obviously there's Paris Saint-Germain versus Olympique Lyonnais. There's also a Brittany derby with Nantes v Rennes. And there's a very, very big match between Brest and Monaco. Massive clash for the UEFA Champions League qualification. What catches your eye in week 30 of Ligue 1?
Yeah, that Brest-Monaco stands out, doesn't it? I mean, it's such a clash of cultures, clash of teams, clash of histories. You couldn't pick two more different clubs, and it's probably the longest journey as well, isn't it, Ligue 1? I know I keep talking about geography, but I think that is the longest journey, Monaco to Brest, I would imagine. That's the one to look out for. And we're going to see, like, can Monaco keep going? Can Brest keep going? Can Monaco kind of start getting the form that they need to get over the line? That's going to be a fascinating match. And the fans were fantastic. You know, I watched that Brest game, and they're starting to believe, you know, and it's going to be a tough trip for Monaco to go to the northwest of the country. So that's a real standout game. It's got to be up in Brest. And we've got to say, look, if Brest win that, they're not over the line, but they're really close to Champions League football.
No, but it's just about really done, close, isn't it?
Yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely. There's also Le Havre versus Metz as well, which is going to have probably could be nails in coffin time for Metz. Clermont are away to Lens as well in week 30. There'll be only four matches left after that, so we could be seeing a little more clearly about what's happening. We'll be back in 2 weeks' time on Le Bourget to wrap up all of that and more. PSG looking to stitch up the title, the musical chairs for Europe and relegation. It's all starting to get very, very serious, and we'll, of course, be covering all the staggeringly important topics in French football, starting with Paris Saint-Germain's two-match quarterfinal in the UEFA Champions League against Barcelona, Marseille against Benfica, Lille versus Aston Villa. We'll be reviewing all that. We're going to have another clue for your chance to win that Terram Moffi signed Nice jersey. And Andreas, we're not letting him off the hook that early. He'll be back with our latest installment of the Ligue 1 Legends Cult Players Series. He's going to be looking at a certain Juninho Pernambucano, clearly the greatest free-kick taker in the history of Ligue 1, and most of us would say the man that revolutionized free-kick taking anywhere around the world. If you think Andrea Pirlo, if you think Ronaldo, well, they all learnt the trade from watching frame-by-frame videos of Juninho while he was at Olympic Lyonnais. Get onto YouTube. He scored 100 goals for Olympique Lyonnais, and most of them were free kicks from closer to the halfway line than they were from the goal. Of course, we'll have all of that, an exhaustive variety of other salient whatnots from the world of French football. So until then, on behalf of the entire Le Bourget team, from Andreas Evagora, Baptiste Reynaud, and myself, Robbie Thompson, and the rest of the lads, bon match and à bientôt.
Well, it's been coming.
Put in by Jonathan Davies. Kylian Mbappe brings the pass to